This is Age of Treason Radio.
First thing I remember was asking Papa why. For there were many things I didn't know.
On the White Network.
By the hand, saying someday you'll understand. Well, I'm here to tell you now that you never mother's gone. You better learn your past, you better learn your young, for someday it never comes.
With your host, Tan Stoffel. The title of this installment is Jewish Crypsis, Religion, Part 4. The last time I talked about peoplehood and the fact that the Jews are a people, not a religion. This time what I'd like to talk about is related. It's sort of a consequence of their peoplehood. It's an indication, three prominent indications of themselves, thinking of themselves as a people and behaving as a people. But what's interesting about these three examples is they're associated with the religion. And every time I listen to the previous installments that I've done, I catch myself falling into this trap of referring to what the Jews do as religion. At the same time, I'm saying they're not a religion. It's not religion as we understand it. And I apologize for that. I feel idiotic after I hear myself doing it. What I'm doing, of course, is falling into the trap that and making the mistake that they really would like the stupid goyim to make, which is to think of it as religion in the terms that we think of religion as spirituality. And these three things that I'm going to talk about this time have little to do with spirituality and much more to do with peoplehood, because, as I've said, they use religion as a cover, basically, as one of many excuses to not be seen as a people. That came out pretty clearly the last time one of them actually said that they need God so that they aren't seen as ethnic chauvinists. And, in fact, this idea of religion as a cover, or as one of many excuses for themselves, is that it's the main excuse, really, and that's why it's worth four parts to talk about. And I think I've got one more that falls under this crypsis and religion aspect, so you can look forward to that. One of the benefits of posing as a religion is that it is grounds for special treatment and privileges. And that's the three things I'm going to talk about this time are all aspects of that. One of the advantages of taking on the pretense that you're a religion is tax benefits or that you have special holidays and special traditions and special things, specialness. I mean, to sum it up in one word, special. You know, you're special because of your religion. And the Jews play that to the hilt. Even the ones who are secularized want the days off from school. And it more so, I think, is a sort of passive-aggressive. It's not so much that they want days off from school as it is. It's just a way to whine and complain and get attention when they want it. And at the same time, the religion can be used as a shield, as something to hide behind, and to have privacy when they want it to do that. And they play it both ways. It's a reason to argue against them being excluded from anything, because they cry about that being discrimination and persecution, and that it shouldn't be allowed. And at the same time, it gives them an excuse to exclude and discriminate and gather themselves as Jews. for their own, you know, quote unquote religious purposes. It gives them a tool by which to maintain their own identity, and that being a two-part thing, it's both memes, it's the thinking, the ideology of what it is to be a Jew, and it's the genetics as well of what it is to be a Jew, and the one reinforces the other. Really, they go hand in hand. One of the most important aspects of that is Jewish schools, which is one of these things that's associated mainly with the religious Jews, the Orthodox Jews, the quote-unquote religious Jews. And the purpose, as any parent who's thought about homeschooling their child, the whole purpose of taking that kind of control over your kid's education is because you care about, you know, how your kids are raised, what their identity is, what they're going to be taught to think, how they're going to be taught to think. And when Jews take their kids and send them to Jewish school, it's because they want them to be trained to be good Jews, to think of themselves as Jews, to understand what it means to be a Jew. And I've made the point many times before, and it'll come out in this installment as well, that probably that whereas everything else can change, whether you believe in God or not is flexible, and the Jews are, to sum it up, adaptive to changing conditions to continue themselves as Jews. One of the things that doesn't seem to change is this idea of themselves as persecuted. It comes up in every facet that I examine about Jews and Jewish identity, is this idea of persecution. And as I've said, I don't take it literally anymore. It's what they want people to do, to feel sorry for them, and it's sob stories, really. I interpret it more as an excuse to misbehave and to be aggressive to the people around them. It's basically a license to treat other people like crap because, hey, after all, Jews have suffered. And how many times, I can't count the number of times, that I've actually seen a Jew spell out that line of thinking that, yeah, well, Jews are doing something bad, but it's only because, you know, of the thousands of years of mistreatment at the hands of whatever. You know, it comes up every single time Jews are caught with their hands in the cookie jar doing something bad. That's what comes out, and that's why it comes out, that image of them or that painting of them as victims, because they're flipping it around. They're trying to make you feel on the defensive about you and your people. So to take them away from having to, that's their defense, is to go on the offensive. But anyway, this has all been a very long introduction for the three ideas that I want to talk about. The first of which is the word Moser. And this is a word that apparently even Jews, the more secularized Jews, aren't all that familiar with. But it's a concept that everybody is familiar with. Moser essentially means informer, at least according to the sources I've said. I think what it really means is race traitor. Now, that's the specific meaning of it, and specifically a Jewish race traitor, a traitor, you know, betraying the Jews. Now, one of the sources on this word that I'll link and discuss here is from the Jewish Encyclopedia, which is available online, and it claims it's the unedited full text of the 1906 Jewish Encyclopedia. And they have entries on a variety of things, and one of their entries is on Moser. And they describe it as an informer, denunciator, or delator. I don't know what that word means. I've never seen that before. But and then it lists a bunch of synonyms, other words that are totally unfamiliar to me. The last of which, Portuguese, Spanish variations, because these are the communities that Jews have lived amongst historically. Nothing was more severely punished by the Jews than talebearing, and no one was held in greater contempt than the informer, on account of the fact that his deeds frequently caused mischief and even entailed death and destruction. The sages of the Talmud compared the Moser to a serpent. There's a little bit of, without the word persecution being used, but that's what they're alluding to there, that, that, you know, this informers would lead to persecution. The reality is, as they say, nothing was more severely punished and no one was held in greater contempt than a Moser, an informer. And this article, the one complaint I have about this Jewish Encyclopedia article is that it's not very forthcoming about the fact that it is a very specific Jewish meaning to the word. In fact, all of their nonsense about, oh, this is the Spanish synonym and this is the Portuguese synonym, they make it sound like Moser is just the Jewish word for informer, as if like it's a dictionary, a German-English lookup for the word. This is a Jewish-English lookup for the word for informer. And that's not really the sense of Moser at all. As I say, it means specifically a Jew who betrays Jews. And that's clear from other sources that talk about it. In fact, Moment Magazine, a go-to source for contemporary Jewish thought, has an article much along the same lines. It's sort of an encyclopedic entry titled Jewish Word, Moser. And this is from February 2013. And the subtitle of the piece is The Jewish Snitch. And it specifically introduces this subject because of a Hasidic Jew in New York who was recently sentenced to over 100 years in prison for sexually abusing a little girl that he was supposedly tutoring. And so I'm assuming that her identity is being kept secret, but I assume that she's a member of the Jewish community as well, that she's a little Jewish girl. And so anyway, and that's the context for them to be talking about this word Moser. And the reason why is because there were Jews who were upset about this sexual predator being turned over to the police. In fact, it says they were furious. Some of them were furious that he was turned over to the police, and they consider the girl to be a Moser. And they define Moser, and they say it's a rabbinic term for a Jew who informs on another Jew. Now, a rabbinic term means if this is something out of the Talmud or Tanakh, out of their oral or written law, out of their quote-unquote religious side, this concept of Moser. They mention how it's not a term familiar outside of the close-knit ultra-Orthodox Jewish communities. But the rabbinic law mandates that a Jew may not report another Jew's malfeasance to a secular government, even when the behavior in question violates both secular and Jewish law. I think that's an interesting point. What they're saying there is that even if the Jews are aware that what that Jew is doing is wrong, that it's the Jew who reports that Jew, who rats them out. You know, and there's, you know, a variety of synonyms for this word Moser in ordinary English: rat, fink, snitch, stool pigeon, canary. They're all negative, like Moser is. It's negative against the person who commits this supposed crime. And the interesting thing about it is the crime is betraying criminals. That's what it means. And even conscious of the fact that it's criminality that's being betrayed, what's really important to the Jews who use this word Moser and get upset about Mosers is that they're upset about a criminal act being unveiled, being displayed openly, because it's bad for the Jews. The article goes on to say, by placing a fellow Jew in mortal danger, and this is kind of a leap of Jewish paranoia, a leap in Jewish logic to immediately think, you know, being betrayed means, and this is where the persecution comes in, this always thinking themselves as persecuted people, because the chain of logic is supposedly that by turning in a Jew to the authorities, you're exposing them to mortal danger. They might be harmed in jail. And that's worse, supposedly. You know, this is really an excuse for the damage to the Jewish community that it does, the embarrassment and the difficulty that it causes to other Jews to do that, to continue their criminal behavior if they're revealed. You know, they don't really care about what happens to the guy who gets caught so much. Although there is that feeling of cohesiveness that the Jews have too, that even for one of their own, that they'll stand up and he didn't do nothing. He's got to be innocent, and the whole society is guilty before Jews will agree that a Jew is guilty. By placing a fellow Jew in mortal danger, a Moser takes on the status of a rodef, another Jewish word, which literally means a pursuer or one who is chasing a victim with murderous intentions. Here's how they're literally flipping it around. You know, the Moser is the bad guy because he is acting as if he's chasing a victim. And the victim now is the person, the criminal, who the Moser revealed to the secular authorities. An individual or community is permitted to stop a rodef by any means necessary, even if it means killing him before he has the chance to kill his intended victim. And that's how they escalate it. They invert it, and then they escalate it. They say, well, you know, this person is up to no good, the Moser is, and could result in the killing of a Jew. And so, therefore, we're justified to kill him. This is related to how I concluded the last time and said, you know, that the Jews seeing themselves as persecuted, as I was anticipating getting to this point, in seeing themselves as persecuted, as that being the central aspect of their identity and what it means to be a Jew, it enables them, consciously or not, this is the consequence of them defining themselves this way, is that they then feel justified to aggressively lash out at the people around them, to aggress against others. With this thinking, that's why this concept of Moser is important to understand and to dig into the thinking behind it of Jews. This is, you know, you can to call it paranoid really is not right, because it's not wrong for them to think this way. It's just extreme. It's beyond what white people are used to thinking in favor of ourselves, in favor of our own people. Jews think thoughts like this about their people and what's good for their people, and these are the extreme levels that they will go to. We better kill this guy because he might kill a Jew, or he might do something that leads to the killing of a Jew. And they just it escalates immediately to that level in their minds. And in fact, as authority, they cite some Jewish law professor who actually says that I don't have to go to a Jewish court, a bet din, he calls it, to ask them if it's okay to kill somebody. I've got to stop him right there, says this authority on Jewish law, this professor of Jewish law at DePaul University. They go on in the article to try and make the excuse that, well, you know, it's kind of complicated. It's not so cut and dried. You know, the rules against informing don't really pertain to actions that harm the community. And they give the example of somebody who actually endangers the safety of other Jews, like violent criminal Jews, that they're okay to turn over to the authorities. Except in the case that they're actually talking about here, which contradicts that confusion. Here's a case where this older rabbi was abusing a young Jewish girl. And I admit that I'm kind of coming to that conclusion. I'm connecting the dots there. I don't know for sure that she's a young Jewish girl, but there's every indication that she is. And despite the fact that he's harming her, another Jew, they still get angry about it. They're still furious, is the word that the article started off with. So it's a bunch of bull. Really. And it's about, is it good or bad for the Jews collectively? And one Jew harming another Jew coming out in the open is not good for the Jews collectively. And so they react this way to it based on this long-standing concept of Moser, which is rooted in their religious tradition, quote unquote religious. The second concept I'd like to discuss is called Kol Nidre. And, you know, I apologize for mispronunciation. I'm not a Jew, so I don't, other than in print, I haven't really heard this word pronounced. This is a much more prominent and well-known thing, although the Jews don't like to talk about it. And the reason why is obvious once I describe it to you. Here again, Jewish Encyclopedia has an entry on Kol Nidre, and they describe it as the prayer recited in the synagogue at the beginning of the evening service on the Day of Atonement, one of their high holidays or a significant day, very significant day to Jews. And in the 19th century, it was expunged from the prayer book of many communities of Western Europe, many Jewish communities. It has often been employed by Christians to support their assertion that the oath of a Jew cannot be trusted. Well, why not? I mean, they act as if this Kol Nidre is a construction of Jews, I mean of Christians, rather than Jews. It's a Jewish thing, and you know what it is something that the Jews themselves don't want to confront, and so therefore they take it out of their books. But it, like changing their names or changing their noses, it's not because they want to stop thinking it or stop being Jews. It's just because they see that it exposes them, and so they try to change it in that way. Or if they flip it around and it's, you know, the Christians who notice this, they're the ones with the problem. They repeat this prayer, this Kol Nidre. It's not really a prayer. It's more of a statement. And it's a statement of the essence of what it means to be a Jew and what it means to see how they view non-Jews and how they view themselves as a people and everybody else who isn't part of their people. They repeat three times. All vows, obligations, oaths, and anathemas, whether called a couple of Jewish words here, or by any other name, which we may vow or swear or pledge or whereby we may be bound, from this Day of Atonement until the next, whose happy coming we await, we do repent. May they be deemed absolved, forgiven, annulled, and void, and made of no effect. They shall not bind us nor have any power over us. The vows shall not be reckoned vows. The obligations shall not be obligatory, nor the oaths be oaths. In other words, they're saying ahead of time, before I make any sort of promises, these are all just synonyms for promises and obligations to anyone, that I'm basically off the hook for them. I'm saying right up front here that they're just nonsense. They're just words. They're meaningless. And this is something that, again, this is a very significant concept. It's all Jews know about this, whether they actually get together with their Jewish friends and family to actually perform this rite or not. They may not, but they're all evasive about the subject and because they don't want to be Mosers. They don't want to betray a secret of the Jewish community, which is, you know, borderline criminal. It's, you know, certainly hostile and indicates hostility to the people around them to undertake such an oath against oaths is what it amounts to. You could see it that way. And the third and final thing I want to discuss here, and this is another prominent thing, probably the most prominent celebration that Jews are partake in, more significant than the other two things, in fact, is the holiday of Purim and these figures of the villain Haman and the heroine Esther. And again, I'll cite and link an article on Purim from the Jewish Encyclopedia, which gives the details, the surface details of what Purim is, that it describes it as the Jewish feast celebrated annually over the course of 2 days in commemoration of the deliverance of the Persian Jews from the plot of Haman to exterminate them, as recorded in the Book of Esther. So that would be from the Old Testament, the Jewish Tanakh, Book of Esther. And it's a tale that you have to go elsewhere to actually find out the details of. It's not in the Jewish Encyclopedia, or it's sprinkled over so many other entries. it wasn't very convenient for me to find information there about it. But there was another page titled Judaism 101 Purim at jufac.org, which had some more meat to it. And it says, right at the top, the significance is it remembers the defeat of a plot. This is of Purim. Remembers the defeat of a plot to exterminate the Jews, observances, public reading of the Book of Esther while, quote-unquote, blotting out, unquote, the villain's name. The Book of Esther, it sums up as, the story of Purim is told in the biblical Book of Esther. The heroes of the story are Esther, a beautiful young Jewish woman living in Persia, and her cousin Mordecai, who raised her as if he were his daughter. Esther was taken to the house of Ahasuerus, king of Persia, to become part of his harem. The king loved Esther more than his other women and made Esther queen. But the king did not know that Esther was a Jew. Here's an interesting element of Jews and their crypsis, pretending not to be Jews, hiding. And here, Esther fooled the king. Now, she's the hero of the story. And fooling the king is no doubt one aspect to Jews of her heroism. You know, fooling other people, as long as they're not Jews, that's okay. That's the point of having a particularist morality. If it's good for the Jews, and it turns out, that's the summary of this story. I'm not going to read the entry here from jufact.org about it. I'll sum it up in our terms from a white point of view. It's a story that makes this guy Haman out to be this demonic enemy that wants to exterminate the Jews for no reason whatsoever, as usual with the Jews and the Jewish telling of history from their point of view. It's always about extermination. It's always for no reason whatsoever. And it's always all the Jews. And the hero is Esther, who fools the king, this Persian king, who's not Haman. Haman is some other king. But tells this Persian king that, oh, I'm a Jew, and this other evil guy wants to kill my people for no reason whatsoever, and can't you do something to help me? And basically tricks him into sending Persians to die to protect the Jews. And that's what Purim is about. When the Jews are celebrating Purim, it's about tricking one set of goyim to kill another set of goyim for the benefit of the Jews, and doing it by deception. First of all, by pretending, by the example Esther sets of getting sexually involved with one powerful goyim in order to manipulate him through deception. And the business about extermination is, of course, in the end, the moral of the story is that it was the other people who got exterminated, the Persian people who don't exist anymore, and Haman and his people, and the Jews celebrate that. These are our examples, these three things that I've discussed this time, of how the Jews see themselves as a people, and how it's actually painted as religion, that these things are religious concepts, but it's really about their peoplehood. And that's what's important. I don't know how many times I can say that, but it's the most important point of these last several installments. So I hope you got it this time. The Jews are a people, not a religion. And persecution. That's important too. You write a song.